With Theodore Retke, we change our method a little bit. Mr. Retke has preferred to prepare a statement on this subject rather than to deal with it through question and answer. Mr. Retke, will you read to us?
What do I like? Listen. Hinks, minks, the old witch winks, the fat begins to fry. There's nobody home but Jumping Joan and father and mother and I. Now what makes that catchy, to use Mr. Frost's phrase? For one thing, the rhythm. Five stresses out of possible six in the first line. Though maybe old doesn't take quite as strong a stress as the others. And three, keep noticing that magic number, internal rhymes. Hinks, minks, winks. And notice, too, the apparent mysteriousness of the action. Something happens right away. The old witch winks, and she sets events into motion. The fat begins to fry, literally and symbolically. She commands. No old fool witch, this one. Notice that the second line, the fat begins to fry, is absolutely regular metrically. It's all ions, a thing that often occurs when previous lines are sprung or heavily counterpointed. The author doesn't want to get too far from his base, from his ground beat. The third line varies again with an anapest and variations made on the O and U sound. There's nobody home but Jumping Joan. Then the last line, anapest, lengthening the line out to satisfy the ear, and father and mother and I. Sometimes we're inclined to feel a Mother Goose, or the traditional kind of thing, is almost infallible as memorable speech. The phrase is Auden's, but this is by no means so. There's another version that goes, hink, mink, the old witch stinks, the fat begins to fry. Nobody's home but Jumping Joan and I. Now, the whole situation has obviously altered, for the better perhaps, from the standpoint of the speaker at least. But in his excitement, he has produced a much inferior poem. First, deleting the S's takes some of the force away from the three rhyming words. Hinks, minks, the old witch winks, the triad. What's more, he has become tiresome naturalistic. The old witch stinks, hardly a fresh piece of observation. Stinks a splendid old word, but here it's a bore. It's the prerogative of old witches to stink, part of their stock and trade, as it were, and nobody mentions it. Take the change from minks, which means, of course, a pert little vixen of a girl, and carries with it overtones of tenderness, or, further back, a wanton, a roaring girl. And the mink, a wonderful little predatory animal with a characteristic odor. But if we keep that in mind, the line becomes an olfactory horror. It's some fusty little cave these two have in the absence of father and mother. And their absence takes away the real drama from the situation. It's a roll in the hay and nothing more. Allow me another I love. I-N spells in. I was in my kitchen doing a bit of stitching. Old Father Nimble came and took my thimble. I got a great big stone. Hit him on the belly bone. O-U-T spells out. Here we see how light I and short I and feminine endings can make for speed, rhythmical quickness, velocity, and then with the words following the action, that truly awesome and portentous line with its spondees, I got a great big stone. And then the sudden speed up in the action, the triumphant release from a frustration, I suppose the Freudians would say, hit him on the belly bone. O-U-T spells out. Take another, a single line, which is always a test. Great day, little A, bouncing B. There are three shifts of pace. It's a triad again, with lovely alliterations, the long, full vowels combined. Names themselves can be a love in half the poem. Julius Caesar, Pompey Green, wore a jacket of velveteen. Here we're cranked up by four trochees in the first line. The second line would be dull by itself, But that first line, the impetus of it, is still bearing us along. What's my real point by these little examples? It's this, that while our genius in the language may be essentially iambic, particularly in the form of lyric, much of memorable or passionate speech is strongly stressed, irregular, even sprung, if you will. Now we see that the name itself, the direct address, makes for the memorable, for rhythmical interest. Often it means an implied dialogue. Take the ridiculous, "Oh, Father dear, do ships at sea have legs way down below?" Of course they do, you goosey you, or how else could they go? Or if you can stand my Scots, "Quo the Tweed to the Till, wha gars ye gang sae still? Quo the Till to the Tweed, there ye're in with speed, and there in slaw. For ilke een a gee droon, I droon twa." But you may protest, these are the rhythms of children, of folk material, strongly stressed, memorable perhaps, but do they appear in poetry today? The answer is yes, certainly in some poets. For instance, Auden's, "The silly fool, the silly fool, was sillier in school, but beat the bully as a rule. The youngest son, was certainly no wise one, yet could surprise one. Or rather, to be posh, we gather, one should have no father." Then the cryptic and elliptical end, simple to prove that deeds indeed in life succeed, but love in love and tales where no one fails. Not all Mother Goosey, to be sure, and the rather father rhyme maybe comes from Sam Johnson's, "If a man who turnips cries, cries not when his father dies, it must prove that he would rather have a turnip than a father." Or to take an example from myself, a piece I need. In the first section, the protagonist, a little boy, is very sad. Then there is a jump rope section in which two children chant in alternate aggressive dialogue. Then their aggression trails off into something else. This goes, "Even Stephen, all is less, I haven't time for sugar. Put your finger in your face and there will be a booger. A one is a two is, I know what you is, you're not very nice, so touch my toes twice. I know you are my nemesis, so bibble where the pebble is, the trouble is with no one, yes, as you can see, I guess. I wish I was a Piffle Bob, I wish I was a funny, I wish I had 10,000 hats and made a lot of money. Open a hole and see the sky. A duck knows something you and I don't. Tomorrow is Friday. Not you I need. Go play with your nose. Stay in the sun, snake eyes." Some of the poems I cherish from the dramatists have heavily pronounced, strongly stressed swat rhythms. They're written to be sung or maybe danced to. Here from Ralph Roysterdorster, "I mun be married a Sunday, I mun be married a Sunday, whosoever shall come that way, I mun be married a Sunday. Roysterdorster is my name, Roysterdorster is my name, a lusty brute I am the same, I mun be married a Sunday. Christian customs have I found, Christian custom have I found, a widow worth £1,000, I mun be married a Sunday," and so on. Notice that shift in the second stanza, in tone and feeling, how it goes into another speed rhythmically. George Peele, that wonderful poet, abounds in incantatory effects with the same propulsion. Here's the opening of a dialogue. "Fair and fair and twice so fair and fair as any may be, the fairest shepherd on our green, a love for any lady." And later, "And of my love, my roundelay, my merry, merry, merry roundelay," concludes with Cupid's curse. "They that do change old love for new, pray God they change for worse." Repetition in word and phrase and an idea is the very essence of poetry, and particularly of this kind of poetry. Notice how these poets can and do change the pace, and the change is right psychologically. We say the command the hortatory often makes for the memorable. We're caught up, involved. It's implied we do something, at least vicariously. But it can also be very tricky, can seem to have a factitious strength. The emotion must be strong and legitimate and not fabricated. Thus, when Eleanor Riley writes, "Go study to disdain the frail, the overfine," I can't get past the first line. There's no conviction, no natural rhythm of speech. I suppose there must be an element of the startling or the strange or the absurd. Yeats is magnificent often at getting the right tone, seizing the attention. "Call down the hawk from the air, let him be hooded or wild," or "Come swish around, my pretty punk, and keep me dancing still, that I may stay a sober man, although I drink my fill." Or Dunn's, "So, so, break off this last lamenting kiss." I think of Bogan's "Come Break with Time" as a supreme example of this kind of thing. "Come break with time, you who are lauded by a clock's chime so ill afforded. If time is allayed, be not afraid. I shall break if I will, break since you must. Time has its fill, sated with dust. Long the clock's hand burn like a brand. Take the rock's speed and the earth's heavy measure. Let buried sea drain out time's pleasure. Take time's decrees. Come, cruelies." Here's the strong stress again and the emotion powerful. We're into the theme immediately, a great theme always, but one that few can handle, say anything new about today. And notice the cunning shift in rhythm in the last stanza, the pickup in energy, the change, reminding me always, and perhaps this is deliberate, of the Wordsworthian, "No motion has she now, no force. She neither hears nor sees, rolled round in earth's diurnal course, with rocks and stones and trees." In some more serious poetry, we see again how the direct address can pull us up sharply. We're used to this in spoken language. Maybe we hark back to the condition of the child when we're being told. Almost invariably a dramatic situation, some kind of opposition, is indicated. Thus in Charlotte Muse, "Sweetheart, for such a day, one mustn't grudge the score." Or Dunn's, "When by thy scorn, O murderess, I am dead." But the action itself can be dramatic, as in Herbert's, "I struck the board and cried no more." Or the situation can be given dramatically, as in Cunett's, "Within the city of the burning cloud, dragging my life behind me in a sack, naked I prowl." Nor must we forget the rhetorical question, as in W.H. Davies' lovely and little-known poem, "V is for Venus." Is that star dumb, or am I deaf? Hour after hour, I listen here to catch the lovely music played by Venus down the evening air. Before the other stars come out, before the moon is in her place, I sit and watch those fingers move and mark the twitching of her face. Hour after hour, I strain my ears for lovely notes that will not come. Is it my mortal flesh that's deaf, or that long-fingered star that's dumb? And he ends with a question, you'll see. To question and to affirm, I suppose, are among the supreme duties of the poet. But what about the rhythm, the motion of the poem as a whole? Are there any ways of sustaining it, you may ask?
We must keep in mind that rhythm is the entire movement, the flow, the recurrence of stress and unstress that is related to the rhythms of the blood, the rhythms of nature. It involves certainly stress, time, pitch, the texture of the words, the total meaning of the poem. We've been told that a rhythm is invariably produced by playing against an established pattern. Blake does this admirably in The Poison Tree. I was angry with my friend. I told my wrath. My wrath did end. I was angry with my foe. I told it not. My wrath did grow. And I watered it in fears, night and morning with my tears. And I scented it with smiles and with soft, deceitful wiles. And it grew both day and night till it bore an apple bright. And my foe beheld it shine, and he knew that it was mine. And into my garden stole, when the night had veiled the pole. In the morning, glad I see, my foe outstretched beneath the tree. The first and third lines in the first stanza have really only two stresses. The lines said in an absolute rush, I was angry with my friend. I was angry with my foe. But each is followed by a perfectly regular iambic four-beat line. I told my wrath did end. I told it not, my wrath did grow. The whole poem is a masterly example of variation in rhythm, of playing against meter. It's what Blake has called the bounding line, the nervousness, the tension, the energy in the whole poem. And this is a clue to everything. Rhythm gives us the very psychic energy of the speaker in one emotional situation, at least. But there are slow rhythms, too, where we're not always emotionally high. And these, as any practitioner will find, are very difficult to sustain in poetry without boring the reader. Listen to Janet Lewis' Girl Help. Mild and slow and young, she moves about the room and stirs the summer dust with her wide broom. In the warm, lofted air, soft lips together pressed, soft, wispy hair, she stops to rest and stops to breathe amid the summer hum, the great white lilac bloom scented with days to come. Here we see particularly the effect of texture, especially the vowel sounds, as well as the effect of the dentates, the D's and T's. The first line sets the pace. It can't be said fast. Mild and slow and young. It's a little vignette, very feminine, absolutely true emotionally, the drowsy adolescent. But the poem is not static. The girl moves. She stirs, she stops to rest, and stops to breathe. At last, a real pickup in motion. And the girl, virtually embraced by the season, is part of herself. It's nonsense, of course, to think that memorableness in poetry comes solely from rhetorical devices or the following of certain sound patterns or contrapuntal rhythmical effects. We all know that poetry is shot through with appeals to the unconscious, to fears and desires that go far back into our childhood, into the imagination of the race. And we know that some words like hill, plow, mother, window, bird, fish, are so drenched with human association, they sometimes can make even bad poems evocative. I remember the first time I heard Robert Frost read in 1930. Suddenly a line, I think it was from Shakespeare, came into his head. He recited it. Listen to that, he said. Just like a hiss. Just like a hiss. It's what Eliot has called the auditory imagination, the sinuousness, a rhythm like the tail of a fish, a cadence like the sound of the sea or the arbor bees, a droning, a hissing, a sighing. I find it in early Auden. Shall memory restore the steps and the shore, the face, the meeting place? Shall a bird live, shall a fish dive, and sheep obey in the sheep's way? Can love remember the question and answer, for love recover what has been dark and rich and warm all over? Or, to quote from my own The Lost Son, the protagonist, we're told, is hunting, hunting along the river, down among the rubbish, the bug-riddled foliage, by the muddy pond edge, by the bog holes, by the shrunken lake, hunting in the heat of the summer. The shape of a rat, it's bigger than that. It's less than a leg and more than a nose. Just under the water it usually goes. Is it soft like a mouse? Can it wrinkle its nose? Could it come in the house and the tips of its toes? Take the skin of a cat and the back of an eel and roll them in grease. That's the way it would feel. It's sleek as an otter with wide, webby toes. Just under the water it usually goes. Curiously, we find this primitiveness of the imagination cropping up in the most sophisticated poetry, in Eliot, in Stevens. She sang beyond the genius of the sea. And he keeps playing with that wave-like, repetitive motion until the whole poem reverberates, resounds to the pitch and swell of the sea itself. Stevens can also intone and doodle platonically, but it's the wildly nutty ones of his I cherish. Thus, the garden flew round with the angel, the angel flew round with the clouds, and the clouds flew round, and the clouds flew round, and the clouds flew round with the clouds. Is there any secret in skulls, the cattle skulls in the woods? Do the drummers in black hoods rumble anything out of their drums? Mrs. Anderson's Swedish baby might well have been German or Spanish, yet the things go round and again go round. 'Twas rather a classical sound. A real piece of sophisticated looniness. We haven't lost, we've recovered, in Stevens at least, the secret of being lyrically funny, and we're closer, rhythmically, I think, to the nursery rhyme, the poem out of the common speech. If we concern ourselves with more primitive effects in poetry, we come inevitably to consideration, I think, of verse that is closer to prose. And here we jump rhythmically to a kind of opposite extreme, from many strong stresses, or a playing against an iambic pattern, to a loosening up, a longer, more irregular foot. I agree that free verse is a denial in terms. There is, invariably, the ghost of some other form, often blank verse, behind what is written, or the more elaborate rise and fall of the rhythmical prose sentence. Let me point up, to use Mr. Warren's phrase, in a more specific way, the difference between the formal poem and the more prose-like piece. Mr. Ransom has read his beautiful elegy, Bells for John Whiteside's Daughter. I'd like to read Elegy for Jane on the same theme, a poem, I'm proud to say, Mr. Ransom first printed. I remember the neck curls, limp and damp as tendrils, and her quick look, a sidelong pickerel smile, and how once startled into talk, the light syllables leapt for her, and she balanced in the delight of her thought, a wren, happy, tail into the wind, her song trembling the twigs and small branches. The shades sang with her, the leaves, their whispers turned to kissing, and the moles sang in the bleached valleys under the rose. Oh, when she was sad, she cast herself down into such a pure depth, even a father could not find her, scraping her cheek against straw, stirring the clearest water. My sparrow, you are not here, waiting like a fern, making a spiny shadow. The sides of wet stones cannot console me, nor the moss wound with the last light. If only I could nudge you from this sleep, my maimed darling, my skittery pigeon. Over this damp grave I speak the words of my love. I, with no rights in this matter, neither father nor lover. I think any reader would agree that Mr. Ransom's is a superior piece, the emotion subtler, more complex, and kept in control, the psychological distance maintained with great skill, the understatement of Brown's study, for instance, and the rhythms, the light eyes, and the off rhymes, the feminine endings, body, study, the whole thing in beautiful balance, a truly classical restraint. Behind this piece, as in a hearty lyric, lies a whole world. There's an immense tenderness, that rare quality in modern poetry, in Mr. Ransom's elegy. It makes me want to love all of the South, and that's an undertaking. But let me indicate one or two technical effects in my little piece. For one thing, the enumeration, a favorite device of the more irregular poem. We see it again and again in Whitman and Lawrence. I remember, and then the listing, the appositions, and the absolute construction. Her song, trembling, etc. Then the last three lines in the stanza lengthen out. The shade sang with her, the leaves, their whispers turned to kissing, and the moles sang in the bleached valleys under the rose. A kind of continuing triad. In the last two stanzas, exactly the opposite occurs. The final lines being, over this damp grave, I speak the words of my love, I, with no rights in this matter, neither father nor lover. There's a successive shortening of the line length, an effect I've become inordinately fond of, I'm afraid. This little piece indicates, in a way, some of the strategies for the poet writing without the support of a formal pattern. He can vary his line length, modulate. He can stretch out the line. He can shorten. If he is a real master, he can, like Christopher Smart, make virtually every line an entity in itself, a poem, as he does in his magnificent ode to his cat, Jeffrey. Here are a few excerpts. For I will consider my cat Jeffrey, where he is a servant of the living God, duly and daily serving him, where at the first glance of the glory of God in the East he worships in his way. For this is done by wreathing his body seven times round with elegant quickness. For he is of the Lord's poor, and so indeed is he called by benevolence perpetually. Poor Jeffrey, poor Jeffrey, the rat has bit thy throat. For I bless the name of the Lord Jesus that Jeffrey is better. For the divine spirit comes about his body to sustain it in complete cat. Or he can jump over a stick, which is patience upon proof positive. Or he can catch the cork and toss it again. Or he is good to think on, if a man would express himself neatly. For by stroking of him, I have found out electricity. For God has blessed him in the variety of his movements. For though he cannot fly, he is an excellent clamorer. Or his motions upon the face of the earth are more than any other quadruped. Or he can tread to all the measures upon the music. Or he can swim for life. Or he can creep. It was Lawrence, a master, this sort of poem. I think I quote him more or less exactly, who said, it all depends on the pause, the natural pause. In other words, the breath unit, the language, that is natural to the immediate thing, the particular emotion. Think of what we would miss in Lawrence and Whitman and Charlotte Mew, or more lately, in Robert Lowell, if we denied this kind of poem. There are areas of experience in modern life that simply cannot be rendered by either the formal lyric or straight prose. We need the catalog in our time. We need the eye close on the object in the poem about the single incident, the animal, the child. We must permit poetry to extend consciousness as far, as deeply, as particularly as it can, to recapture, in Stanley Kunitz's phrase, what it has lost to some extent to prose. We must realize, I think, that the writer in freer forms must have an even greater fidelity to his subject matter than the poet who has the support of form. He must keep his eye on the object, and his rhythm must move as a mind moves, must be imaginatively right or he's lost. On the simplest level, something must happen in this kind of poem. The smart sort of piece, or the biblical catalog, is really easier to do than the free poem in a shorter line length. Let me end with a simple and somewhat clumsy example of my own, in which we see a formal device giving energy to the piece, that device being simply participial or verbal forms that keep the action going. Big wind. Where were the greenhouses going, lunging into the lashing wind, driving water so far down the river all the faucets stopped? So we drained the manure machine for the steam plant, pumping the stale mixture into the rusty boilers, watching the pressure gauge waver over to red as the seams hissed and the live steam drove to the far end of the rose house where the worst wind was, creaking the cypress window frames, cracking so much thin glass. We stayed all night stuffing the holes with burlap. But she rode it out, that old rose house. She hove into the teeth of it, the core and pith of that ugly storm, plowing with her stiff prow, bucking into the wind waves that broke over the whole of her, flailing her sides with spray, flinging long strings of wet across the rooftop, finally veering, wearing themselves out, merely whistling thinly under the wind vents. She sailed into the calm morning, carrying her full cargo of roses. So we'll leave Rettke and his manure machine.